It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and with the chance that I might lose professional status, I have to tell you that I started eating iceberg last winter. Now, this is the lettuce that generations of food pros have loved to insult. The classic one was, iceberg is the only salad that you can rinse off and dress again tomorrow. But I liked it. And then I noticed that the iceberg wedge was in fancy restaurants. I mean, heck, French god Danielle Ballou is serving this thing at something like $15 a pop. An idea hit. I think iceberg is going to go from low class to hot trend. Let's face it, it's cheap and it's perfect for the times. Well, stay with us. There's more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, this is sort of a party show, maybe not your usual entertaining guide. The ideas this week are a little off-center, but, you know, they're kind of fun to try with friends. Now, for those who take their wine far too seriously, our fancy sommelier-turned-maverick, Josh Wesson, loosens things up with his wines for weenies. Or how about some delicious geekiness? Concoct your own sodas, but I mean sensational sodas. And since independence is in the air, why not break free from paying money for your food? I mean, that's so 20th century. Why not learn how to eat for free, or close to it? Well, Hank Shaw's been doing this for a while. Now, as a former chef, he's got a leg up on the cooking side, but his book, Hunt, Gather, Cook, Finding the Forgotten Feast, takes us down some new paths, literally. Hank, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Hank, when did you start foraging?
I've been foraging since really almost before I could walk. I mean, I started as a very, very young boy when my family would take vacations out in on Block Island, which is an island off the coast of Rhode Island near Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard. We would, well, boy, my mom didn't make a whole lot of money, so she would pack up the truck and we would drive all the way out and take the ferry over. But all that was in the truck were canned goods and, you know, Tang. I developed a weird love of Tang in my youth because of that. And she would send us out all over the island foraging. You know, pick the blueberries, pick the beach peas, pick the, you know, the rugosa rose hips. Let's go clamming, you know, let's go fishing. And that kind of became, you know, my idyllic summer. And we did that for a good number of years when I was a little boy. And, I mean, when you're – life really starts like that. It's hard to shake it.
Right. Well, you know, that's what I want to talk about. I'd like to talk about how you forage at the water's edge, both salt water and fresh water. But let's look at fresh water first. What can we find at a lake or a stream that we might not even realize we can eat?
Well, it sort of depends on the lake or the stream, but depending on where you are, most streams in America will have crayfish living in and around the rocks. Obviously, there's lots of fish in lakes and streams, and cattails. I mean, I think a fair number of us know that cattails are quasi-edible and are not really certain exactly how. But a good thing in the summertime, you know, the cattails in the summer will have my favorite edible, you know, treat that's on the side of the water in summer, and it's the pollen of the cattails that I like the best.
Pollen of cattails.
Exactly. It's if you look at the cattail, right, the little brown hot dog, right, and then above the hot dog will be this sort of tufty, bright yellow stuff, right? And that's the pollen. The pollen's all attached to the flower. And what you do is you sort of take an empty milk jug and you cut a hole in it and you put it over the yellow part and shake it. And all the pollen will drop off. And you very quickly, moving down in a stand of cattails, can get tablespoons and cups of this stuff, and it is the most wonderful yellow color you ever wanted to imagine, and it's a great addition to muffins or to pasta or to any kind of flour-related product, and it gives you this vivid yellow color and kind of an interesting nutty taste to it. It's sort of vaguely walnutty.
I remember burning cattails to get rid of mosquitoes. I just never thought about the pollen piece of it.
Well, the pollen only comes in midsummer, so depending on where you are, it can appear anywhere from now until, you know, early September even.
What else can we find?
Well, there's if you're inland, you know, in the center of the country, there are there's something called American lotus. And if you've ever had lotus root in an Asian dish, it's more or less the same thing.
Oh yeah, the root is a long sort of oval, and it, when you cut across it, it has this beautiful pattern of holes in it in a circle.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And that you dig in the fall. They're not quite as big as the Asian lotus, but they're pretty close. And then right before you dig the roots in sort of late summer, early fall, you get lotus nuts. And you can also buy those in a Chinese grocery store. And they're wonderful. I mean, the lotus, if you've ever seen it, has this gigantic, beautiful flower. And it just sort of looks like what a water lily dreams about being. And then that flower, when it goes by, forms this very hard seed head. And in the seed head are all these nuts. And you have to break the seed head to get the nuts out. And the nuts themselves are kind of hard to crack. But once you get inside, they're really delicious. They're almost macadamia nut-like, but they're not quite as rich and fatty as macadamias.
This is under the category of who knew? Okay, what about salt water?
Salt water, that's my wheelhouse. I mean, I've been a beach picker forever. And, I mean, I could go on and on and on about all the wonderful things about the seashore. But I think if you ever wanted to start with something, try beach peas. They look exactly like English peas, except they're smaller. And they grow in sand. And they're on both coasts. And you can, if you find a good patch, you can pick big bowls of them. And this is the first thing I ever really foraged. I mean, my sister's actually telling me the story because I was too young to remember that, you know, me walking down the beach and say, oh, look, peas. Because I guess as a baby I had a predilection for lots and lots of, like, pea baby food, which they all thought was nasty, but I guess I liked it.
Right.
And so I started picking them.
Uh-huh. And do you cook them the way you normally cook a pea?
Yes, very lightly. Just maybe a little butter, maybe a little salt, and that's about it. Because they're just, you kind of want to, I mean, if you go through the trouble to get the beach peas, you kind of want to just enjoy them as they are.
There is a plant that looks like it has a crisp, very, very narrow fingers. And it is crunchy, and it's salty, and it's just delicious. And I remember the one time I had it in a restaurant, it cost an absolute fortune. And I know it comes from the water's edge.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
What is it? What is it?
That's sea beans. It's a salicornia would be his Latin name, and it's called sea beans or glasswort or saltwort or chicken feet. It's got all kinds of funny names. But yeah, I know what you're talking about. That's one of my absolute favorite seaside veggies. I mean, it's and it grows in salt marshes. It grows on the edge of high tide in a protected area where it's salty, and it is it's an amazing plant for just kind of a summer vegetable because all you really want to do is blanch it just briefly,
just a little boiling water, just to set that
just
color.
A little,
yeah,
maybe a minute. And it sets that brilliant, almost, jade green in it. And then all you have to do is just toss it with olive oil and maybe a little black pepper, no salt, and you're good to go. I mean, it's such a good flavor. It's crunchy. It's as crunchy as you ever want it to be. And it's salty and briny. And it just – there's kind of a green bean undertone to it
Yep.
My favorite part about it is I know a spot right near my house that's the size of a football field.
All right, that's cheating. I'm sorry, Jack. That's really cheating. I'm just
doesn't cost me nothing but gas.
Oh boy, you go out and you dig up some clams and you have that. I'm dying here. Hank, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hank Shaw wrote Hunt, Gather, Cook, Finding the Forgotten Feast. Now, try his recipe for pickled sea beans or sea rocket pods and know that peas or green beans could stand in if you don't have an ocean down the block. The recipe's on the website, splendidtable.org. And on that very same site, there's a lot more in store. Register for our monthly book giveaway. This month, it's Tender by English writer Nigel Slater. And get registered for the Return of Griller's Chronicle, our special edition e-newsletter, absolutely free. And this year, when you sign up, you're automatically registered for a giveaway of a big batch of Griller's goodies from Sur La Table. And I mean a big batch. Take a look, guys. SplendidTable.org. Summer sets in at the sea. You said feeling loveless. You play a part, painting it a new star. Life lesson number one. We know a lot more than we think we do. So trust yourself. And if that trust gets shaky in the kitchen, take two generous doses of Sally Schneider and instead of calling me in the morning, stroll up to that stove and go for it. Sally is a pro who cooks by feel and imagination with some very fine success. And appropriately, she's the author of The Improvisational Cook. Hey, Sally. Good to have you back.
Good to be here, Lynn.
So, how do you get the most out of a fresh cherry? What's your take on that?
First is buy a good cherry, which means buy a nice, plump, firm cherry that's not overripe and not underripe. I go for Bings because they're the most delicious and common. In farmers markets, you can find other varieties sometimes. These are sweet cherries. Sour cherries are meant for cooking. But for serving fresh cherries, my all-time favorite thing to do is put them in a bowl, add some ice to the bowl, and then some water, and let them sit for about 5 minutes. There is nothing like an iced cherry as a dessert, and all you have to do is put little bowls around for people to put their pits and stems. I suggest you have a lot of cherries if you're going to serve them this way. They're just addictive.
All right, so now if you want to gild the lily.
Here's a simple pairing is fresh cherries with some creamy goat cheese, maybe with a few leaves of thyme on it. Another thing I like to do, actually, is pit the cherries and toss them with some lemon juice and sugar until their juices run. Then I mash them into a really good vanilla ice cream with a dash of balsamic vinegar. It's kind of like an impromptu cherry ice cream, which you can't buy anymore. And if I'm really in the mood to keep morphing things, I throw it in the blender and turn it into a cherry milkshake.
That sounds incredible. Okay.
Yeah.
Cooking cherries. Do you cook both the sweet cherries and the sour cherries?
Yes. You can cook both of them exactly the same way, adding lemon juice and sugar. Those are essential components, and you would just vary the amounts depending on the kind of cherry. That being said, for my money, sour cherries are the best for cooking. They have the most complex flavor, and it's a very old-fashioned cherry flavor, actually. So then, if you're going to cook a cherry, the question inevitably comes up of whether to pit or not to pit. I used to pit cherries that I cooked, and you have a couple of options. You can use a hand pitter, which you do one by one, or you can get one of these $20 chute pitters where you throw a bunch of cherries down a chute and with a plunger action, you pit them. So I used to do that. And then one day I took several baskets of cherries that happened to be sour cherries. I didn't realize because I didn't have my glasses on, to a friend's house for dinner. They had stems and leaves. We were both exhausted. We were pulling together a dinner party and we looked at the cherries and we looked at each other and said, do we need to pit these? And I said, why don't we just throw them in the pan and see what happens? So we did. We did this kind of sauté braise of sour cherries with stems and leaves, served them in a big bowl with alongside of a bowl of creme fraiche. And each person could pick a cherry by its handle and pop it into the creme fraiche and then into their mouth.
Ooh. And you had sautéed it with sugar?
Yes. So they were plump and bursting with juices and warm. And you'd eat them one at a time. Your fingers would turn red. The delight at the table was incredible. And you just put the stems and leaves in a little, we put bowls around the table and you throw away the stems and leaves. It was a revelation and a liberation because I realized you don't really need to pit the cherries.
This is ideal. And the work is absolutely zilch.
It is zilch. Now, if you do want to pit cherries for whatever reason, there is a virtue in doing it, and that is that the pits have wonderful flavor. It's both the flavor of cherry wood and almond and the little bit of cherry flesh left on it. And I take those pits and either steep them in a very good vinegar, maybe a mix of balsamic and sherry vinegar to make an aged wood tasting cherry vinegar. So it's a kind of side benefit.
Now, if you were to put that vinegar with those fresh pitted cherries in the ice cream.
Yeah. See, there you go. That's exactly right.
Thanks, Sally.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Sally Schneider's book is The Improvisational Cook, and it's celebrating its 10th year with a new edition. Now, you can find that recipe for warm, fresh cherries with leaves on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back with Parties in a Glass. That's Wine for Weenies from Josh Wesson and The Homemade Soda Brief. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Josh Wesson is a born-again wine sommelier who loves a bargain and can probably come up with a wine match for any food you could imagine. Josh, good to have you back with us.
Good to be back.
So, Josh, big challenge, pairing. What do you drink with a hot dog?
I was afraid that the day would come when you would ask me this question on the air.
I knew you've been dreading this for a long time, but here it is.
Well, you know, we're a hot dog loving country, and I'm a hot dog loving guy. We eat billions of these things. I think 15 or 16 billion the last time I looked it up on the Hot Dog Council's little list of fun facts. And almost half of them are consumed between Memorial Day and Labor Day. So, you know, it really is kind of a seasonal phenomenon. But I love hot dogs, and I love the way that we eat hot dogs, and I love the many different ways that people think of topping hot dogs, because when it comes to eating hot dogs and matching wine with them, it's not so much about the dog, but it's about what you put on top of it.
That makes sense. I mean, that's the same premise as the hamburger. I remember you saying it's the special sauce you go after. It's not the burger itself.
It is. Like, there are so many regional hot dog styles in America, more, I would wager, than there are for hamburgers, that it becomes a kind of sommelier's big test. Because depending upon where you are, whether you're in Rhode Island eating a Rhode Island Coney, or up in Rochester eating a White Hot, or you're having an Italian-style dog in Jersey, or you're having a kosher-style dog in New York, I mean, there are a million different variations on the dog theme, and it all comes down to what you stick on top. And the stuff on top, you know, directs you, like a bird dog, right to the right wine.
Okay, so let's talk these regional dogs then, okay? So tell me about the Rhode Island dog and what you drink with it.
Well, they end up putting chopped onions and meat sauce and mustard and a dash of celery salt on. And they call them the New York System hot dogs, even though you can't get a hot dog like that anywhere but Rhode Island. It's like getting a Coney Island hot dog in Michigan that they don't serve on Coney Island. With that dog, with the wild riot of flavors, the dominant taste is both the meat sauce and the mustard. So you get tanginess from mustard, and you get the richness from the meat sauce. And the best thing that you can possibly have with something like that is a sort of light, fruity red wine that you can chill, like a Beaujolais. You could find a Beaujolais Village, not a fancy pants one from an individual village, but a straight Beaujolais Village,
right,
a Dubuque or a Dordogne. Stick them in the fridge, treat them like they're white wine, and that will be able to handle a Rhode Island-style dog with ease, no problem at all.
So what about the New York dog?
The New York dog, classic in its simplicity. A little steamed bun, usually mustard and sauerkraut. And if it's a kosher-style dog, it's got a snappy skin on it. And if it's a kosher dog, a true kosher dog, then it doesn't. But the dominant taste is the mustard and the sauerkraut.
Uh-huh.
And when you have all of that vinegar and all of that tang, it's best to go for a kind of slightly fizzy, mouth-watering, vinous version of a beer. And one of my favorite go-to wines for a mustard and kraut dirty water dog is a Vinha Verde from Portugal. And the slight effervescence of the wine and the low alcohol and the high acidity all make for a great palate-cleansing gulp, which washes down the mustard and the kraut and the dog and lets you come back for more. Two of my favorites these days, twin vines goes for about $10, $11.
Mm-hmm.
And a broad bent Viña Verde, which is a little bit more expensive because it's a little bit finer in terms of its complexity. It's all of $12, so for $2 more, you can trade up a bit. But it won't really matter because you'll lose all that complexity when you bite into the mustard in the crowd anyway. But those are good combinations.
So how about a Coney Island?
Coney Islands usually have a little bit of chili sauce, chopped onions, shredded cheddar, and sometimes they can have sweet onions or sweet pepper on there. So you've got a sweet and savory thing happening. And as soon as you add an element of sweetness, whether it's on a traditional coney or maybe even something as simple as relish and ketchup mixed in with mustard and other savory condiments, you better find a wine that is both sweet and sour. And my favorite wines that are sweet and sour to go with hot dogs that are also kind of, you know, rich and fatty and a little bit salty are Rieslings from the Mosel, from the northernmost wine-producing region in Germany. They don't have to be fancy Rieslings. In fact, they can be entry-level Rieslings that they call QBAs. They have a nice kiss of sweetness, and that sweetness handles the sweetness on the top, and then the acid below cuts through the coney or the dog, you know, and it just makes for a beautiful match based on both similarities and contrasts in the wines and the dog. Nothing better, I really think. And a couple of my favorites are the Graf Mosel QBA, goes for about $10, and the St. Urban's Hof, which is a little bit more money, about $13, $14, and you get a little bit finer representation of the Riesling grape, but equally delicious with the hot dog with a little bit of sweet and sour topping on top.
Just makes me want to go out and eat hot dogs all over the East Coast. Josh, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Find Joshua Wesson's Wines for Weenies on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, to go with those wines, try David Rosengarten's San Gennaro Burger. It's Italian sausage, meat, and beef. And it's on that website, too, splendidtable.org. Jada Michael Stern tracked Culinary Americana, the local gems, the places you want to eat at when you're on the road instead of the places we usually end up settling for. Now, the good thing here is that they share. Hey, Jane, Michael, what's up this week?
Well, you know, Lynn, we're always looking for really unusual, interesting foods, the likes of which we might not find at home. And whenever we hear about some really exotic dish, you know, suddenly that goes to the top of our hit list and we're always looking for it. Long ago, we heard about a dish called Arkansas wedding cake. Now, that sounds pretty interesting if what your interest is regional food. So we went to Arkansas. We looked in every small town. We looked in Little Rock. We looked throughout Arkansas and asked every waiter, waitress, do you have Arkansas wedding cake? They all shrugged, had no idea what we were talking about. So we kind of gave up in our quest, drove over to Mississippi to do a little food hunting there. We're sitting in a diner and somehow mentioned Arkansas wedding cake. The waitress started laughing hysterically, and she said, oh, you mean white bread. That's what we call white bread around here.
Really?
Yes. And that got us thinking about all of the
different... Got us thinking about how little we knew about American food, because this was probably 1976.
But it alerted us to how many dishes there are around the country that are known euphemistically. I mean, one of the most obvious ones is Rocky Mountain oysters. Now, Lynn, you know what those are, right?
Yes, I do. Yes,
okay,
I do.
Okay, they're the tenderest part of a young male bovine. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
They also go by the name of swinging beef, or tendergroin is another name for them.
I didn't know that one.
Yes, there are so many words like that. I mean, one of the rarest ones, but actually we saw it fairly recently in the Midwest, is a dish called city chicken. Now, one would assume that city chicken is chicken, but in fact it's not. It goes back to a time when chicken was a kind of luxury food, and they would make fake mock chicken using veal. And in fact, there are still taverns and restaurants in the Midwest where they serve city chicken. They now don't make it with veal because that's way too expensive, but it's made with pork, and they'll make like a little fake drumstick, and that will be your city chicken made with pork.
The other thing that I love is kind of fancied up names of foods that
their real taxonomy is actually quite disgusting. Like orange roughy, which, you know, is on every menu now. The fish is really called a slime head, but I don't think people would, you know,
let's
run,
have slime head for supper.
Right. And Chilean sea bass is actually the Patagonian toothfish.
Or so, how about a plate of sweetbreads? Or would you prefer to have some thymus glands on your plate?
That would be a really hard sell. Really hard sell.
You know, a couple of years ago, this was one of the stupidest things that I've ever encountered. The Prune Council of America decided to change the word prune to dried plum and banish prune from the dictionary, but I think it failed, so thank God prune is back.
Prune just never sounded very good, and they're delicious.
So, yeah,
they
like
are.
Prune whip. And I think what Michael was talking about earlier about city chicken gets into the whole category that has pretty much disappeared but was rampant during World War II of mock because of the war food shortages. And you know, there was mock apple pie made out of cornflakes.
Well, Ritz crackers.
Crackers.
That recipe
exactly.
was on, I think it may still be on the box.
So do you think there was a peanut shortage that led to circus peanuts?
What are circus
the
peanuts?
Candy?
They're these big orange candies that look kind of like tennis shoes.
Oh, yes, yes.
They're
yes.
always stale, and the staler the better,
I think they're
really.
Made stale.
They're made stale, yeah.
And the funniest thing about them is that they're banana flavored.
Yeah, why they're called circus peanuts, who knows?
Maybe. Like, why didn't they make them yellow and call them circus banana? Well, I guess elephants don't eat bananas.
Right. So, I guess they're elephant-sized peanuts.
So our
right?
new assignment is to look for all of these euphemisms and then...
And send them to us.
Okay. Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye.
Jane and Michael's latest book is The Lexicon of Real American Food. Now, you can get their very latest finds on the website, splendidtable.org. The craft beer movement has taken us into some new territories. Craft sodas. Sodas that you can describe like wine, waxing poetic over shadings of flavor, remarkable body, delicious aftertaste. And the good news is that you can make your own. Andy Schloss has done a book, Homemade Soda. And in it, he wants us to aim high. He wants us to go for the gold and make extraordinary ones. Well, Andy joins us. Andy, good to have you with us.
Great to be here, Lynn.
All right, so here's the deal. What's wrong with just going out and buying a bottle of Coke?
You're just so used to doing that. You can, and it's so easy to make your own soda. One of the great things in life is figuring out how to take this commercial product that everybody has that you never thought you could make at home and make it, and it's really easy. So it's just too much fun to make, so why go buy it?
All right, so how do you make soda?
Soda is basically a flavor base. So you would brew a flavor base, which is can be a tea, it can be a coffee, it can be a fruit juice. You would sweeten it some, and that's one of the big advantages of making your own over commercial soda. Most of my recipes have about half the sugar that would be in a commercial soda.
Uh-huh.
And once you make that base, which takes a couple of minutes most of the time, you would then just dilute it to whatever degree you want and carbonate it. And in the book, we have three different methods of carbonation. The easiest thing to do is just take seltzer water and dilute it with seltzer water, which would have your dilution and also the carbonation in it. If you have a soda siphon, you can just mix it with plain water, which is much cheaper, and then carbonate that with a CO2 cartridge in the siphon. Or the oldest method of doing it, which gives you a really soft bubble carbonation, is to dilute it with water and then add a little bit of what's called champagne yeast or wine yeast, and then put it in a bottle and let it sit there, and the yeast will feed off of the sugars in the flavor base and create carbon dioxide, and it will become naturally bubbly.
I never would have thought of wine yeast in a soda.
Yeah, making soda and making alcoholic beverages at one time was pretty much the same thing. If we're making wine or we're making beer, you would put yeast into some sort of sweet mixture, either grape juice or a malted grain. And then the yeast will feed off of the sugars and they will produce carbon dioxide and alcohol. When you're making wine, you would burp the mixture all the time to get rid of the carbon dioxide to get more and more alcohol. If you're making soda, you trap the yeast and the carbon dioxide in the bottle, which then gets it very bubbly, and you would stop the fermentation within a couple of days so you don't produce very much alcohol and you produce a lot of bubbles.
All right, so we're talking about three different kinds of carbonation.
Correct.
If I could have the same flavor base done with three different kinds of carbonation, would I be able to taste the difference one to another?
That's a great question. Absolutely. It is not a taste difference. It is a huge textural difference. When soda is commercially carbonated, the carbon dioxide is forced into the liquid at about 120 pounds per square inch, which is a gigantic amount of pressure. And you get this really intense bubbling in it. And so when you open a bottle of soda, there is all this fizz that gets released. You know, there's just sort of like goes
out the top
because the carbon dioxide is so forced in there, it just wants to come out. And that kind of carbonation doesn't feel like bubbles. Bubbles have this sort of soft, velvety kind of idea about them. But the carbonation in commercial soda that's under great pressure, it almost feels like pinpricks. It's this really violent kind of carbonation. If you do a soda siphon, you're going in at far less pressure than that, and you're going to get a kind of, it feels sort of like tickle, like feathers, like tickly bubbles kind of thing. And if you do this yeast carbonation, it's very, very soft, like foam, sort of this velvety kind of carbonation. So they're very different mouthfeels.
So, okay, let's talk about making soda. And what occurs to me, of course, is the all-time favorite, colas. Can I do that?
Oh, absolutely. And cola is one of my favorite things to make because it's so weird. It's such a weird flavor system. I mean, one of the things that is extremely cool about cola is that we think we know what it is. It's cola. But if you actually try to sit down and figure out what that flavor combination is, it's bizarre. It's not like any flavor that ever existed. And it's because it was created as a medicinal, so that it is basically a bunch of different juices and spices mixed together for medicinal purposes that we have come to view as a refreshing flavor. So what a cola flavor system is basically citrus juice, and you can use any citrus juice. I usually use a combination of orange, lemon, and lime, both the zest and the juice.
Uh-huh.
And then there's coriander in it, which is pretty strange, nutmeg, cinnamon, a lot of cinnamon, and a little bit of vanilla, and that's basically it. At one point, there was this stuff called cola nut, which is sort of like a cocoa kind of thing. It is not used in colas anymore. It was the original caffeinated ingredient that went into colas. I tend to not put caffeine in my colas. Caffeine doesn't have a flavor, so it's unnecessary. So basically, you brew this kind of tea from those ingredients to make cola, and then sweeten it, let it cool, and then strain it, and then carbonate it. Actually, the funniest thing about cola is when you make this tea, the syrup is sort of cloudy, clear. It doesn't have a color.
Right.
But because cola has caramel coloring in it, you just add caramel coloring to it, which doesn't really have a flavor, but it doesn't quite taste like cola until it becomes brown. As soon as it's brown, it's cola.
And what is the caramel coloring? What do you use? Do you
make
caramel?
It's burnt sugar. I mean, like Kitchen Bouquet, that like caramel coloring that you would buy to...
Oh, so you get it buy the bottle. Buy the bottle.
Absolutely,
okay.
Yeah.
So it doesn't taste like cola until you make it brown.
Not quite. I mean, if you close your eyes, it could, but...
The power of suggestion.
Yeah.
Hey, Andy, this is very cool stuff and certainly worthy of a summer project. Thank you, sir.
It's a pleasure talking to you.
Andy Schloss is author of Homemade Soda. Now, Andy left us with the recipe for natural cola. You're going to find it, well, you know where, splendidtable.org. Okay, time for this week's trivia question. In honor of the 4th of July, here it is. Who threw the first ice cream social in the White House? Well, we're going to be back with that answer, and you and I are going to talk. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment, so you can get in touch. Connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send us an email, splendidtable.org, or call us, 800-537-5252. But before we talk, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was in honor of the July 4th holiday. Who threw the first ice cream social in the White House? Well, I have to say, this is really too easy. First Lady Dolly Madison used the ice cream social to soften up Washington politics. This was around 1812 when her husband James Madison was president. Now, from what I've read, the woman was charm personified, born to diplomacy, lovely, and she knew the politics of the dinner table inside out. Any recent first ladies come to mind?
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me.
It is time to get in touch. The lines are open. We're talking with you, and anything goes. Reach us at 800-537-5252. Connect with us on Facebook. Check us out on Twitter. Send us an email, splendidtable.org. We have Amalia on the phone from Corvallis, Oregon. Amalia, hello.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
I'd like to talk about marshmallows.
Oh, I love marshmallows.
I want to know how to infuse floral flavors and tea flavors.
Do you make your own?
Yeah.
Oh.
And I'm wondering if I should infuse the flavor into the sugar first.
Yeah. That's exactly what you should do.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely. That's exactly what you should do.
No, I have jasmine tea, and I'm trying to figure out how do I get that tea flavor, not too strong, just a nice subtle flavor.
Right. Normally you would put the herbs or the flowers right in the sugar and rub it in, then let it sit for a couple of days. And then you pull that out and the sugar will have that aroma. But when you're dealing with something small like tea leaves, it's hard to separate it out.
Right, right.
Hey, I've got an idea. Why don't you improvise a tea bag? Take a thin towel.
Okay. Cheesecloth maybe?
Cheesecloth would be perfect. I think we've got the solution. You put the jasmine tea inside the cheesecloth. You put the cheesecloth into the sugar, and you let it, you mix it around. You smush the cheesecloth a little bit just to get the scent activated, and you let that sit for a couple of days, and you should end up with jasmine-scented sugar.
Oh, nice.
And I would use a fair amount of that tea because, it's going to dissipate as it goes into the marshmallows.
I got it. Okay.
Yeah. But, you could do basil marshmallows with just basil leaves in that sugar. You could do mint marshmallows. You could do thyme marshmallows.
Oh, how exciting. So many flavors to try.
The other thing you could do is lemon and orange with the rinds.
Well, and I have some rose water, too. I want to try that.
Rose water, though, may be tricky.
Yeah.
You want to, try it. See what you think. Try it. See how it smells when it gets into the sugar. If you don't care for the smell of it, then you're not going to like the taste of it.
Okay.
Okay? Orange flower water is a little less tricky.
Okay.
Okay? But see what happens.
Oh, thank you.
All right. It's an old trick. Jerry Traunfeld, he's up in Seattle. He used to be at the Herb Farm, which was this great restaurant, and he's a wonderful herb cook. And he mentioned this business about infusing your sugar when you're baking or whatever with any kind of herb you want. It was one of those duh moments where you thought, why didn't I ever think of that? Of course, that makes sense.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
Yeah.
Okay.
So enjoy.
Thank you.
You take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Just file this away. Everybody knows about putting the vanilla bean in the sugar. Well, there's no reason why you can't put the chocolate mint in the sugar. Why not? Clay is calling from Atlanta. Clay, what is on your mind, sir?
Lynn, I was calling about rosemary. It's my favorite herb and the one that I can consistently plant and keep alive, as it's very hardy. However, if I strip the leaves off and then cook with almost anything, like roasting potatoes and so forth.
Right.
They stay somewhat hard and bothersome in the mouth. They're hard to chew.
Yeah.
And my only solution to date has been to use a limb or two with the leaves attached and then have it flavor the saucer juices, and that works fine. But I was wondering, what else can you suggest to get the maximum flavor out of this really great herb?
Well, one of the things you can do is crush it and or chop it. But I have a mortar and pestle that I use. And, you know, whatever else you're using with the rosemary, for instance, if you need some salt that you're going to rub into the food or add to the food, maybe you have a little orange zest. I live for orange zest, by the way. You'll hear this a lot on the show. Garlic, and you can just smash that all together. The rosemary leaves are very, you know, they're shaped almost like an overweight pine needle.
Right.
And they're not something that's easy to really ingest, but you can crush them. And the aroma when you are pounding that stuff together is just fabulous. You could do that in a little mini processor, too, but it's much more fun to do it with a mortar and pestle.
So, right. Well, I appreciate that. I had not thought about the crushing. That's great.
Yeah. Throw a little salt in there, a little garlic, the orange or, you know, lemon zest, anything you want. But that's a great way to do it, and then you can add it to whatever you want. So your problem is solved, sir.
It is, and thank you so much, Lynn. Enjoy the show.
Thank you, sir, and thanks for calling. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You know, one of the things that we tend to forget about, we have food processors and all kinds of machines, but a simple mortar and pestle is just a great thing to work with. The one I like best is from Mexico. It has three legs on it. It's made out of stone, and the pestle is made out of stone as well. And it's called, I think I may not pronounce this correctly, it's a molcajete. And you can find it in a lot of shops. And you have to season it and do a few things to it, but the reality is this thing is the best spice grinder I've ever worked with, and I can crush anything in it, and I can do it really fast. And the smell is fabulous. It's not all contained in this plastic container. It's out there for me. Anyway, 800-537-5252. We have got Robin calling from Colorado Springs. Hi, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
My daughter and I are planning a trip to Europe next summer, and my question concerns French bistro cooking. I kind of got it in my head that bistro fare is mostly heavy and starchy.
Oh, no.
Is this an accurate current perception?
Not at all. Bistros, brasseries, they're not the super-duper formal haute cuisine restaurants. They run the gamut from being places with the lightest, most fabulous seafood you've ever had in your life.
One of seafood. The great.
Oh yeah. I mean, remember, Paris is not far from the sea, and most serious seafood places have their own trucks that go out to the coast to bring in stuff fresh.
Okay.
In fact, there's one dish that I love. It's called the plateau, and you'll see, if people specialize in it, you will see this. And what it is, it's a stand on the table, and sitting on that stand will be a big flat platter, like a pizza dish, pizza plate,
okay,
or, you know, pan, piled with shaved ice. And on that shaved ice would be oysters and clams and mussels and shrimp and pieces of lobster. And you drink a muscadet, which is an inexpensive, crisp, so tart white wine, which tastes fabulous with the fish. There are a couple of guidebooks because, you know, bistro cooking now is everything you can imagine.
I didn't realize it was so varied.
Oh, it's incredibly varied.
But how likely is it that we could get vegetarian dishes?
I really don't think it's a problem. Now, I would say go online, you know, check the New York Times, look at a lot of, you know, sources about food in France, and see, because there could be a lot of restaurants that are really emphasizing this. They may not call themselves vegetarian, but they're going to be emphasizing vegetables. I mean, these days, I think from the very, very fancy white tablecloth restaurants down to the simplest places, unless they specialize in pork or whatever, you're going to find really good food that is not necessarily about meat. And don't forget that some of the finest Vietnamese food in the world is in Paris. Yeah, because remember, they occupied Vietnam
connection.
For many, many years. And there's, of course, brilliant Moroccan and North African food. So, I mean, there's going to be a great many choices there.
Would be right up my daughter's alley.
Yeah, just remember, the label may not say vegetarian.
Okay.
But if you explain, you know, she doesn't eat meat, there's going to be some wonderful things.
All right. great.
Okay, you're going to love this. You are going to fall in love. And that's a city to get lost in.
We'll go sooner now than
well,
we talk
well,
to you.
Really, you want to get, what you want to do is have a good map. You know, you'll be fine. But the point is, wander. The first time I went there, my husband took me. And the very first day, we walked 18 miles. We just followed our noses. This is one of the most exquisite cities in the world. So enjoy.
Thank you.
Bye. We got a voicemail from Allison and Daniel. Thank you, guys. They went strawberry picking last weekend, and they came home with, are you ready for this, 13 pounds of strawberries. But the problem is they're kind of anemic in taste, so they want to know what can they do to improve the flavor. Well, when in doubt, there are two things you can do when this happens. Number one, if the berries are not yet ripe, let them sit for a little bit, because if nothing else, the sugars are going to start to concentrate as the berries begin to just age ever so slightly. The other thing is macerate, okay? Put them in a bit of sugar. Now, they're going to throw off a lot of juice. They're going to change in consistency. Don't add a lot of sugar. You want just a bit. You just want to lift up their flavor. But then you're going to have great taste. And one of the tricks you can do then is put them in a sieve, let all the juice drain into a bowl, boil that down so it's really syrupy, and add it back to the fruit. And now that can go into, you know, shortcake. That could go in just into a bowl, and that's it, because it's so delicious. You can obviously put them on anything. You can put anything you want on them. The other trick, which is done a lot in wine growing areas, is that you take the fruit, you toss it with a tiny bit of sugar, not a lot, and then you cover it with a very light wine. It may be a rosé, it may be a crisp white, it could be a really, you know, kind of light-bodied red. A Tempranillo would be good, for instance. You could do a Sauvignon Blanc. And you put that in the fridge, and you let it get stone cold, and you take that out on the hottest night, and you just eat that up with a spoon. And some people might put a little cake with it or something, but I don't think it needs it. I think you just eat it like a soup, and it's fabulous. 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's up next? We have Darko on the line from Lincoln, Nebraska. What did you want to talk about?
Well, I have a spice mystery. A friend of mine came back from Turkey and brought this plastic tube of spices, and I have no clue what they are.
What do they smell like?
Well, it's kind of a mix. There's about seven or eight layers. And so some of the smells have kind of combined. I know there's paprika in there, mm-hmm. but the rest, I don't know.
So they're stacked, essentially, in this tube, right?
Yes, yes.
I think what the best thing to do, because, you know, I'm not sure. I know that there's a Turkish chili that's a rather dark, it looks dark and crumbly. And I think it's Urfra. And it has a piney aroma, but a very fruity one and a little musky. It's not like very many chilies. It has heat. But if you see something in there that sort of looks like a very, very dark red, and it's a little bit crumbly, not ground to a powder, that might be that particular chili, which
it
comes
looks
from...
looks like that might be one of them.
All right. And that would be something you might use with, I think, more powerfully flavored foods. You might use it with, you know, things that are more robust, lamb, pork, beef, or dishes that have, you know, if you were to stew green beans and tomatoes and cinnamon and that kind of thing, a little bit of that would be just delicious. And it's fabulous probably in tomato sauces. So that would be one thing you'd probably find there. Probably some kind of paprika, because, you know, the chilies are all over that part of the world. I mean, the other things are perhaps dried mint. Is there anything in there that looks like it's a dried green leaf, a dark green leaf?
Yes, actually, the next layer is kind of a almost like a military green shade.
Well, that could be that could be dried mint. It could be dried dill, because mint and dill figure heavily into that cuisine. Oregano as well. You know what would be fun to do is take some pieces of paper towel, okay, and mm-hmm. gently ease out of that tube onto each piece of the paper towel a different seasoning. And then let your nose tell you what it's about. And your palate, take a little bit on a dampened finger and put it on the edge of your tongue. And you'll know what it is. And you'll be able to understand what
it should go with or what it might be worth trying with?
There's one that I don't know if I'll be able to figure out. It's a dark purple. I've never seen anything like it.
That's one you got to put on the tip of your tongue. I'm clueless about that one. Maybe it could be dried hibiscus, you know?
Who knows?
Oh, no, dried hibiscus is fabulous. It's tart. But, you know, one of the tricks that chefs use to figure out if they want to put two different spices together or herbs is they put both of them on their tongue together, and they know immediately if they're going to work. So, but I'd say you do each one of these individually and take a swallow of water in between. Hey, you've got an adventure ahead of you, sir.
All right. Well,
hey, enjoy.
Thank you for the advice.
You are welcome. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's the show this week. Thanks for being with us. And remember, you can reach us any way you want. You can follow us on Twitter, connect with us on Facebook, send us an email, splendidtable.org, or call 800-537-5252. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Anonymous, who said, "Only in America do we buy hot dogs in packages of 10 and buns in packages of 8. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, you're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Also, at splendidtable.org is a Splendid Table store where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with Shubha Bala and Judy Boudreau. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Sarah Lear. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. You have a good one. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.